Welcome to The Right Chamber, the podcast that takes you inside the NHS to explore what really makes a hospital a hospital.
Each episode, we sit down with the people who keep healthcare moving, from doctors, nurses on the front line, to students, the support teams, administrators, corporate staff, and everyone in between. These are the voices that often go unheard, but together they form the heartbeat of our hospitals.
Our aim is simple: to share authentic stories that are accessible to the public, meaningful to NHS staff, and a reminder that healthcare is more than treatments and wards. It's a whole community working together.
So whether you're part of the NHS family or simply curious about the people behind the service, join us as we open the doors to the conversations that matter here in the Right Chamber.
Dr. Lucy Martin is a Dudley GP qualified in 1996 and senior partner at Eve Hill Medical Practice. Her portfolio career includes hospice and senior leadership roles across Dudley. She is chief of primary care at Dudley Group NHS Foundation Trust, a deputy lieutenant, and retains interest in palliative care, women's health, GP education, and research.
Welcome back to The Right Chamber. Today we're diving into a part of the healthcare system that often works quietly in the background, but affects every single one of us: general practice.
That's right, Jaspreet. And to help us unpack how this is all evolving, we're joined by someone who really sits at the heart of it.
We'll be talking about how the hospital GP service is structured and why those differences matter for patients.
We're also going to get into some of the major challenges GPs are facing right now.
Finally, we'll look ahead to the future of general practice. What might it look like in 10 or 20 years? And is this a shift patients should be excited about?
So let's get into it. We welcome Dr. Lucy Martin.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hello to you both.
Hello.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm Lucy. I'm a GP. And I'm here as part of my role working at Dudley Group. I do also have a practice in Dudley, and I've been a GP in the area for 25 years now. I did also train in Dudley, so I was a junior doctor back in 1996 and onwards. So I've been in Dudley for quite a while.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. So you know the whole Dudley scene, Sandwell area as well. Okay, Derek. And you are now chief of primary
care. Yes. For Dudley, yes?
Yes, I can tell by your questioning approach that this is an unusual role. It is unusual. It's a new role. The role was developed in October 2024, so it's only just been over 12 months that I've been working for the trust. But before that, I was working for another community trust, delivering their primary care services, and then that trust merged into Dudley Group in October. So the services that we were looking after in the community came with us. So a new role was created and a new division. So we have a fourth division in the trust now, which again, many people aren't particularly aware of. That's called Place Division. And then that looks after some of the community services that we run. It's different from the other community services that you might be familiar with, like district nursing, occupational therapy, that kind of thing. But we have two general practices that we run as a trust. And I think that's unusual for people to hear about.
Exactly. Because like when we think about GP, we think a GP practice. So how would you describe your role?
It's a very multifaceted role. So you may be aware that the other divisions are all run by a sort of management structure called a triumvirate. So there's a lead doctor, a lead nurse, and a lead manager. So I do that role for my division anyway. But then I also have a kind of clinical supervisory support, strategic leadership direction, that sort of thing for the primary care services. So I guess you might describe it as I try and run the two practices that we have like I do my partnership. So I behave like a partner, but I'm not a GP partner. I'm an ordinary employee, the same as everybody else in the team.
Okay.
From a patient perspective, they wouldn't know the difference. They would walk into the practice the same as they did before it was run by a trust. It feels exactly the same. The reception is there. The receptionist is there. They go into the doctor. They go into the nurse. They may go in to see one of the other primary healthcare team members. They don't know necessarily that a trust is the body responsible for running the service.
Okay. So from the inside, exactly like, you know, your exactly community GP, but the running body that is the trust behind it.
That's okay. Right. Yeah, that's right.
And is this something that's getting more common, or is it, has it always kind of been like this?
It's been common probably in the last 10 years or so. Some of the other trusts around the Black Country have their own GP practices as well. Royal Wolverhampton do, Sandwell West Birmingham do. I think Wolverhampton were first. And they have a few more surgeries than us. They have about 8, I think. And then Sandwell have a few as well. So, it's getting more common. It's for various different reasons. So partnership is still the kind of mainstay of how GP practices are run. But not every GP wants to be a partner. Mm-hmm. And you may know from your colleagues that not everybody wants to be a GP at all at the moment. It's seen to be a bit of a tricky career path. There's a lot of narrative at the moment around how difficult it is to get a job. So I think people don't necessarily choose it as a career option as maybe as often as they have in the past. So there isn't a pipeline of people coming forward who want to be partners. Partnership has a risk in it as well. It's you have often a financial commitment to your business. So for example, in my partnership, I own the building that we work from. So there's a lot of risk around that. Is the building worth what I've paid for it? All the repairs and refurbishments and all of that, that's all my own personal responsibility with my partners. And again, a lot of young doctors coming through don't want to take on that level of responsibility, which is fair enough, isn't it, when you've got other things going on in your life. So trusts have found an alternative way, I guess, of hosting practices that means it isn't risky for the doctors that work within. So the doctors are all working in that service as salaried GPs rather than business owners. So they don't need to take that kind of business ownership route. They don't need to be involved in HR. They don't need to be involved in the governance. They don't need to be involved in, the legal stuff of buying insurance policies. If the roof blows off in Hurricane Claudia, it doesn't matter. They just come to work. So you can see why people choose maybe alternative ways of running practices nowadays. But it's a mix. I think the general consensus is partnership is what makes general practice strong, because a lot of people are personally really invested in their own service. But equally, for example, the two surgeries we took on at the Trust, it stopped one of them from struggling and they'd had a really difficult CQC review. The old partner wanted to retire and hadn't got anyone to hand it over to. So the idea was we came in as a trust and took it on to stop that practice from closing. You might argue, what does it matter if a practice closes? The patients will be distributed around the area, around other practices, and that's true. There's 42 practices in Dudley now. But if you suddenly have 3,000 or 4,000 patients that are without a home, you can imagine that potentially puts a lot of pressure on the surrounding practices. So you do it to stop pressuring the other practices and putting them at risk of starting to struggle as well.
I'm assuming like these patients will not be able to see their own GP anymore. And sometimes patients build this relationship and all of a sudden they have to like move to a new GP. It's hard.
Yes, it would be.
For both sides.
If a practice dissolved, for definite, I mean, patients really don't like that. It's always difficult for patients when a practice changes hands anyway, because old partners retire, new ones come in, or partners, maybe the numbers reduce from my own partnership, we've reduced from 4 to 3 because we didn't get a fourth partner. So we've employed more doctors as a result, but there's still some stability and continuity there. You've got the same faces that the patients are getting used to, even though they're not necessarily owners of that building, owners of that practice. They still have permanent jobs within that practice. So that's why I say, from a patient perspective, it doesn't look that different. It shouldn't feel that different.
So just taking a step back a little bit. So what kind of drew you into the field of general practice, and then particularly more leadership roles as well?
I always wanted to be a GP right from day one of medical school. Why? I don't really know. I think I didn't really have a lot of exposure to any types of medical career at that stage. My uncle was a local GP and I had sat in a couple of days with him. And the thing that I really liked about how his day went was that everybody seemed to know him and they seemed to enjoy coming to see him. And he had a great relationship with people where it was quite informal, quite humorous. There was, you know, a lot of storytelling around, or even inquiry about how are your children, all of that sort of stuff. And I just thought it felt like a really nice, just the way I think I would like to live my life and my career, supporting people that I know well. And I think one of the things that many patients still really appreciate about general practice is continuity, which you referred to. It's probably much less the case now that you can get the continuity that everyone seeks, but I still really love the fact that I'm looking after families that I've been looking after for 25 years, and I look after the great-grandmother and the great-grandchild, all still in the same same family. One of the things about the Black Country is that families often don't travel that far, so you can still have a very large family within your practice boundary. We've got one family where there are 10 siblings, and they all largely are our patients, and their families are our patients. So you can make those connections. It really helps you with the social aspects of medicine. Yeah. It really helps you when you remember, oh yes, I know you, you're so-and-so's auntie. I remember that when your uncle died. And it gives you just that context of what people are living with in terms of their health. And some of the other things that perhaps they're dealing with their lives helps them, helps you understand maybe why they're presenting as they are, or maybe why they might need a certain angle of care rather than maybe sticking with the absolute strict guidelines. Maybe they need to deviate because of the sort of context in which they're living. So I love all that. And I still love all that. And I think the patients also like that still. And particularly where I work is in central Dudley, which is quite deprived in terms of economic status. We have a lot of deprivation, I guess, and higher rates of things like mental ill health and lots of long-term conditions. So our patients need continuity probably maybe more than some of the middle-class areas might, where you just need to see a doctor because you need a particular thing. It's easy for us, isn't it? We're all medical. You know what you want when you go to the doctors. But maybe for our patient group, it's the continuity is really important.
And I think that's the whole point where when a patient comes to hospital, we don't know them personally, so we're following guidelines, whereas you know them personally, so you may deviate from the norm and talk to them on a personal level rather than you're my patient.
The shared management approach, definitely. It's about partnership, working with them, absolutely. It's why you always get these strange tales where maybe somebody goes to see a specialist, or an oncologist, for example, and they get told about maybe a chemotherapy regime that they want to be started on. And that's the joke is that they want to come back to speak to their GP about it first before they decide, which of course I'm not a specialist in oncology in any way, so it's difficult for me to really advise on the minutiae of any oncology regime. But what the patient wants is to talk about how that is going to affect them and their life and their family, and they know that the doctor who knows them has that kind of wider context in mind, without them having to repeat it every time.
How do you stay positive and keep good morale, you know, with GP practice? Although there's, you know, I've spent some time in GP myself.
I did my placement in GP. Honestly, I hated every single minute. Just because I found it really difficult, because you have 10 minutes and they come in and you're trying to solve everything that you can, but at the same time, you're trying not to overrun. And it's like you said, you know, when families come in, it's so hard to not be emotional and try to sort their problems out. But they also want to talk to you as just a person rather than, you're my doctor, this is my problem. And mental health, that was the hardest part of GP, because you've got restrictions. And yeah, I that's when I was like, well, this is really hard. Like, you know, people think there's this misconception that GP is easy. GPs don't want to work. It's a really hard career pathway.
Yeah.
I think that misconception needs to be cleared.
It is challenging at the moment. That's not always been the case. I think GPs have always been a kind of well-loved member of the medical community in years gone by, but Certainly since the pandemic, things have been perceived that GPs, the way GPs work has changed. So you're right, it is hard to keep motivated sometimes with those sort of circumstances. For me personally, I just like the job. I like the people. You know, I don't really believe in things like the term heart sink patients. I like patients. I like people. They like the continuity, so you can see the value in it. I think a couple of the things you said in your question there reveal it maybe why you found it difficult is that everything seems like you have to sort everything out in all in one go. You don't. Many times you have 25 years to sort something out. That's okay. Mental health consultations can be so much more straightforward if you know someone's context already and you know what their life was like before they became unwell. Again, that stuff around their social context, if you know the sorts of problems that them and their family are already dealing with, you don't necessarily need to delve into that sort of stuff. You know, I think we're lucky. We get a lot of good feedback from our patient group and our patients generally appreciate us. So, you know, I feel like what's not to like. Maybe it's difficult, different being towards the end of my career now. I guess I'm in the last 10 years before I retire. And perhaps I've seen the best of general practice over those years. But I think it is a tough one for new doctors to think about it as you say, a challenging career. What other specialty do you have where you literally have no idea what's walking through the door, but then you have no access to immediate tests or anything really? You've just got your two hands, a little bit of equipment, and probably your main piece of equipment is your ears.
Active listening and just making sure that patients feel heard, which is one of the biggest things that you hear from patient feedback, is that even in that short consultation, I really felt my GP was listening to me. And sometimes that in itself just makes all the difference to how that patient leaves that consultation. Sometimes it's not even, you know, we've had some previous guests on as well who've talked about treatment and healing. Sometimes it's not just about what you've prescribed, but actually the outcome of the conversation or the education that the patient has gained, and maybe renewed confidence or reassurance that you've been able to give that patient. And I think that's the magic of GP.
Very much so.
Because whatever they come in with, it may seem like a small problem, but that's not a small problem to them.
Indeed. Or on why today, why now? If you don't normally come in with a cold, why have you come today? What has made you come? What circumstances have changed to make you worry particularly today?
And only a GP would know that. Like if they walked into the hospital, they're like, why are you here? But because you know them,
there's that context.
It's like, what has brought you in? Like, what's going on in your mind for you to actually come for a cold? But yeah, that's...
And you're right, the skill is often about not doing things, not doing tests, not doing prescribing. There are often a lot of harm caused by prescribing and by every investigation, not just mental health consequences, but just once you start uncovering marginal blood results and, you know, all the further investigations that creates, sometimes you just need to sit back and say, actually, let's just keep an eye on this and see what happens.
Yeah. And that's a skill that you probably learned in the last 25 years.
Yeah. The word is uncertainty. Being comfortable with some level of uncertainty. You know, the hospital doctors, we struggle with. We want to know. You know, there's a test that will tell me yes or no.
No, yeah.
Not this borderline. Oh, let's wait a week or two.
But that's your training, isn't it? That's how we're trained. That's how we're all trained in that medical model. The model of curing rather than the model of managing or living with, or even deciding not to have any treatment and thinking about towards, you know, an end of life situation where you want to have a comfortable time rather than spending all that time in hospital having tests and treatment.
Am I right in saying you've done some work or a presentation with the RCGP in the past? Is it on resilience?
Oh yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. It was a master's actually. I did a dissertation on resilience, which ended up being published in the BJGP. I asked me before about leadership and I didn't really discuss it, but it's sort of relevant. I'm from a comprehensive school. I went to a normal school in Dudley. I wasn't a high flyer at school or college really. I got into medical school because of a quota placement that allowed some people from comprehensive schools to get into university without too much obstruction. So I was lucky. So I've always kind of suffered a little bit with, I guess you might call it an inferiority complex. Yeah. On day one, I went to medical school. I remember them saying, you know, you lot are in the top 0.5% of the country here. You need to behave like that. And I was very startled by that kind of approach and the sort of elitist way of it, steeping doctors in that right from day one. So I always felt a little bit other back then and didn't go for things like academic work because I thought it wasn't for me. And so ultimately I was in my 40s and I had the opportunity to do a master's, which was in medical leadership, in fact. And again, that was about trying to qualify my way out of an imposter syndrome, I think. So I think I know what I'll do. I'll get a master's. And then if I get a master's, then I'll convince myself that I'll be all right in leadership roles. It doesn't work, by the way. But anyway, I did this master's. And then the dissertation was on resilience because I was really interested in, it was just as we were coming out of the first wave of the pandemic. There was a lot of talk about how resilience is important at work. There was a lot of talk about burnout and how people felt that their resilience was really obviously very negatively affected by the way the pandemic went. So I was looking very specifically at resilience in GPs in their mid-career. There were at the time a few schemes to encourage people to come into the profession. So the First Five scheme, which looks after GPs in the first 5 years of training. And there are things like the GP retainer scheme, which try and help support people at the end of their careers or when they're maybe thinking about leaving the profession. It gives them a sort of supported role that they could have in usually a training practice or something similar where they can have a fewer sessions, but with a lot more mentoring and support. But there wasn't really anything for the GP in the middle. So I thought, you know, here we are going into work, doing all the work, all these other extremes of the career scale are getting support and we're not. So it was really just a personal interest, I suppose. And I ended up doing this project during the pandemic. And yeah, it was very interesting to discover the sorts of things that made people more resilient at work. So yes, I ended up doing a podcast on that, which is still available to listen to if you are allowed to recommend other people's podcasts. Yeah. I did one for the BMJ as well on the same topic. But yeah, it was just at the right moment that I happened to do that bit of research. But anyway, it made me think, okay, maybe academia isn't as scary as I thought it was. And that now, in fact, I'm the lead for research with my colleague Lloyd in the practices in the trust. And I've been a principal investigator on some trials as well since, including a couple of commercial trials that we've run on a West Midlands footprint. So we've done one, completed one, and we're about to start a second one. So, it can be done. It's leadership is, for me, has been very organic. It's not been something that I decided to do. I just usually put my hands up for things and something comes of it. So that would be, I guess, a piece of advice if anyone was thinking, especially, I think imposter syndrome is not uncommon, is it, in doctors?
No, it's quite
professional.
Yeah. We even actually
We've talked about it probably twice.
Twice, yeah.
Okay.
It started off with like medical students and how they feel like they have
medical
imposter
students,
syndrome.
Doctors.
And we're like, we all do
it
as
gets
well.
Mentioned. Yeah, it gets mentioned. So my tip on that is accept it. It's part of who you are. But put your hands up for things because that's often how you find a career path into something different, or maybe you get a job that somebody else won't do, and ultimately you find that you might be quite good at it. It doesn't have to be by design.
So obviously we've mentioned how like there's like negativity around GP practices and things. What do you think is the future of GP, and how would you suggest that people, it could be improved, and how would you encourage juniors to apply for GP now?
That's a hard question. Yeah. Solving the problem of primary care in Britain. I think we have to accept that the sort of mixed model of delivery of general practice is here to stay. I know that a lot of GP colleagues are not keen on the idea of hospital trusts being involved in primary care because they feel that primary care isn't well understood by trusts, which you said at the beginning that, you know, that's probably a fair challenge, isn't it? However, I think there's good opportunities for GPs like me to work across both settings and be able to bring more knowledge about primary care to trusts, help support trust boards and executives to understand how integral a functioning primary care system is to the success of a secondary care system. You may have seen the stats around GP appointments. Post-pandemic, we're the only area of medicine in England that's managed to increase productivity, not reduce it. So GPs in England are offering 30 million plus appointments per month, which is more than 90% of all of the NHS contacts that happen on every given day. So, you know, imagine if just 1% of that fell over, how much impact that would have on their front door and all the other services within a hospital. So I think trusts are realising this and understanding that you have to have a good and functional primary care to be the best your health system can be. Competition has been strong in the NHS for decades. We come to a time where we've got to work together. And I think that the 10-year plan demonstrates that the government are supportive of what they call a neighbourhood approach, where health is based around smaller geographies, which works for Dudley. So I think the important part for me is that we make sure that primary care is involved in and central to a lot of the decision making when it comes to service development or strategic planning by hospitals. They cannot and must not make plans for their own futures without factoring in what impact that would have on primary care or what support primary care can offer them to make their services more successful. But yeah, I think the partnership model is still here to stay, and I would like to see everybody thriving and primary care being enabled to thrive so patients can have what they need, really, when it comes to that first contact.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, it's the best patient, what will deliver the best patient care that we want at the end of the day. And so, yeah, GPs need support. And at the end of the day, patients who are also on the receiving end of the care also deserve the best support that they can get. So, yeah, I think there's a little bit of, just as you said, accepting the changes that are happening and knowing how we can then use those changes to, you know, to the most effect, both for the staff and for the community.
Definitely. And you asked me about how would I encourage people into the job, which is the bit I sort of slightly avoided. But I think the way the training has gone is helpful. GP training is a bit longer, so I think that's useful. I think it's great that we're now having foundation year doctors coming in and having a sort of a compulsory GP block. I've got a couple of surgeons at the moment in my practice. And, you know, while they're very clear they want to be surgeons, they've really felt the benefit of just seeing what it's like in general practice and seeing how, as you described, how difficult it can be to see that person for the very first time with no resources really at your fingertips.
Learning how to appreciate it.
Yes, absolutely. So when you become the resident surgeon on call and a GP refers someone in, maybe you'll view it with a slightly different view because you know what it must be like to be the doctor on the other side of that with an acute abdomen or maybe a not even unsure subacute abdomen or something that they're not sure about. So I do think that essential GP placement within training is really useful. It does depend on where you get placed, doesn't it? But and we hope that we give people a good experience when they come through.
And some of the GP trainees do say it's a very supportive training program as well, compared to other training programs. So that's a plus.
I like to think we're probably a lot less hierarchical maybe than the hospital setup. But, you know, by definition, we haven't got the old sort of FY1, FY2 registrar of various years. We're just doctors.
Yeah.
All of us seeing patients. So obviously I'm the supervisor, I'm the senior in terms of the kind of age and status, but you're seeing your patients, you have responsibility for your own patients. And I think that we perhaps have a more egalitarian way of managing the team, which maybe feels nicer. I think it feels nicer. I like to work in that setup for that reason.
Thank you so much for a lovely conversation. Some of our audience will be hospital staff, members of the community. Any final thoughts? I think we've had a really very productive conversation.
Well, yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And if you're supposed to come up with a real like a philosophical thing. So probably don't worry about imposter syndrome. Probably put your hand up for things if you feel like you might be interested in them. You never know where they might lead. And then for patients, don't worry about hospitals taking on general practices. It's a way of supporting your practice and keeping your practice going. And you'll still get a doctor that you know, and you'll still get a doctor that you like, and you'll still get a doctor that knows you. So I think hopefully it doesn't feel too frightening for them. And it doesn't mean that they'll be put off by a trust-run GP practice.
Thank you so much again for coming on to the Right Chamber podcast. Thank you so much for everyone who's been listening and following on along. And, you know, as usual, interact with us, like the video, comment. And if you'd like to get involved, get in touch with any of our team members on any of our platforms as well. Brilliant. Till we see you next time.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.